This is an ABC podcast.
Good fella morning, talohani, and welcome to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Eggy Tabol, and would like to acknowledge that our program does come to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. What do we have on the show today? Well, finally, Tuvalu has a new Prime Minister. Traditional leaders from across the Pacific gather today in Fiji for its first ever meeting. And facial recognition technology, is it discriminatory against people of colour? More on that later in the show. Again, I'm Aggie Dubol and this is Pacific Beat. We start off in Tuvalu, where a new Prime Minister has finally been voted in after weeks of anticipation. Fele Titiao was elected unopposed yesterday morning, which is the first in the Pacific nation's history. Marion Farr delves into the new PM's track record and takes a look at the key challenges ahead.
After weeks of waiting, the result came swiftly. Tuvalu's new Prime Minister, Fele Titiao, was elected unanimously by all 16 members of parliament.
Fele Titiao comes to the government of Tuvalu after decades, not only of work for Tuvalu, but also for the region.
Sala Dr. George Carter is director for the Pacific Institute at the Australian National University and has been watching the election closely. Voting for the Prime Minister was delayed by more than 3 weeks because of dangerous weather that stopped MPs from travelling to Tuvalu's capital. But yesterday, they finally got together. Mr. Teo was elected unopposed, and Dr. Carter says he's well equipped for the job.
Fele Titiao is a former Attorney General for the government of Tuvalu before going on to regional organisations where he worked within the Foreign Fisheries Agency, the Pacific Island Forum. At one time, he was the acting Secretary General of the Pacific Island Forum.
His return to politics last year came after a stint as the Executive Director of the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission.
He was one of three, or some would say four, strong contenders that could rally and bring together a government, and he has done so successfully.
The result is being watched closely in Australia, which last year signed a landmark agreement with Tuvalu known as the Falapilli Union. The deal gives Australia effective veto power over Tuvalu's security arrangements with other nations. In return, Tuvaluan citizens are given migration pathways to Australia. Fele Titiao was part of the eminent leaders panel that helped craft the deal.
He was one of the key people who was part of these conversations and understands the ins and outs. And so he will also be very instrumental in taking forth that work.
It's a different stance to one of Mr. Teo's key contenders, Anele Sapuanga, who vowed to scrap the agreement if he got into power. But former Tuvalu government advisor Dr. Jessica Marinaccio says the new PM is still likely to seek revisions to the deal.
The security part of that agreement gives widespread power to Australia to the point of being similar to a US compact of free association. And I think most people see that as being a bit dangerous, having language that says that Australia has to mutually agree on any defence or security issue that Tuvalu would undertake.
There's also speculation about the country's ties with Taiwan, after some MPs called for the relationship to be reviewed. Taiwan's foreign ministry has publicly congratulated Fele Titiao on his election, declaring him a friend. Mr. Teo has not yet spoken about his views on the matter.
Given that he has worked for PIF and WCPFC, all of these places where you'd have to deal with both Taiwan and China and countries that recognize both, I am sure that he has a very comprehensive view on this issue.
But Dr. Marinaccio says the more pressing issue may be climate change, which was brought into the spotlight when dangerous weather caused the Prime Minister's election to be delayed by about a month.
But because people were stuck out on their islands and there was a lot of destruction that happened on the capital itself due to the king tides and the weather, we can see that climate change is a really huge issue.
While the issue is concerning, Dr. Marinaccio believes Tuvalu is in good hands.
There is a really good group of politicians that have been elected to represent Tuvalu this time around, especially internationally. We have MPs from all different skill sets numerous lawyers, former diplomats. So it is just very exciting to look at this group and see what kind of things they're going to be able to do for Tuvalu, which I think is great.
And that's former Tuvalu government advisor, Dr. Jessica Marinaccio, ending that report by Marion Farr. Now, traditional leaders from several Pacific countries are meeting in Fiji today in the first ever gathering of its kind. Organisers say it is an important first step to a Pacific-wide forum of chiefs set to be established in June in Hawaii. Separate from the Pacific Island Forum, which comprises of heads of government, the region's traditional leaders have no formal body. Now, the nobles, which include Māori King Kingi Tuheitia Potatau Te Whiriwhiri VII, are this morning on Fiji's chiefly island of Bau, where ABC's reporter in Fiji, Lede Mavono, joins us now with more details. With that, I say, Bula Lede.
Yandavanaka and Bula to you, Agnes.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. Wow, gosh, what do we know about who was at this meeting and even the purpose of this meeting?
Look, Agnes, I think it must be mentioned from the very beginning that there hasn't been very much transparency around this meeting. I'm told that the organizers wanted to give the chiefs a safe space. And so we have had to work very hard overnight to find out the details. Now, what we know is from Aotearoa, we have the Māori King, King Tuheitia Potato Te Whiriwhiri VII. From Samoa is Tui Atua Tupua Tamasese Tupuola Tufunga Efi. From the Hawaiian Islands, there is a delegation sent by His Royal Highness Prince David Kaumualii Kawa Nanakoa. Today, they're on Bau Island. They're making traditional connections here because apparently, traditionally, they are being hosted by the paramount chief of the province of Te Levu. Now, Te Levu is the biggest province in Fiji, and it's also the head of the Kumbuna Confederacy. That's Naturanga Vunivalu Natuikamba Ratu Epinisa Thakombau. So there's a lot of ceremonies and rituals happening this morning, which I'm quite excited to be laying witness to. But according to a statement from the Secretariat of the Pacific Community, the leaders will spend these next few days finalizing plans for the first ever Pacific Traditional Leaders Forum, which will take place along the margins of the 13th Pacific Festival of Arts and Culture in Hawaii from June the 6th to the 16th. Now, Agnes, we managed to get the foundational paperwork of this forum, and what we understand is that the Pacific Traditional Leaders Forum is going to become a regular platform for Indigenous leaders from across Oceania. And so, as one of the organizers put it, they want traditional leaders to, quote, bring their wisdom and perspectives as leaders with an intergenerational role, as opposed to the short-term political window. So that's a, you know, direct reference to the fact that right now it's only political leaders who make the decisions in the Pacific. And so apparently our traditional leaders want to work together through culture and tradition instead of just politics and trade, which is currently the case, Agnes.
Wow, which is probably a really good thing to hear. Now, I know earlier you said not many people knew about this, so who was actually organizing this event? I mean, what are their objectives?
Well, what we understand is that even the government of Fiji is not financing the event in any way, although they are facilitating some of the arrangements, and it's been through them that we've been able to get access to the event. Media have not been invited to anything. Over the weekend when the chiefs arrived, there were ceremonies, and last night there was a state dinner that you know, there were no media invited to as well. If it weren't for the Māori King's official notification to New Zealand media yesterday morning, we might not have even heard about this leaders gathering. But what we do know, though, is that there are a group of organizations, we haven't even been given the list of organizations who are sponsoring this meeting, but one of those organizations is the Secretariat of the Pacific Community. Now, SPC is a key international development organization of the Pacific Island Forums, and that means, you know, members, including Australia, have access to the SPC. But after this morning's traditional ceremonies on Bau, the chiefs return to the Grand Pacific Hotel for a more formal talanoa, where they're going to really look at this Hawaii meeting in June and decide what the objectives should be, you know, the roles and the allocation of duties between our traditional leaders, and also protocols, because as you know, Agnes, where our chiefs are, there's bound to be a lot of protocols. But interestingly, The timing of this event is quite significant because tomorrow and on Thursday, Fiji's traditional leaders, the Great Council of Chiefs, will meet. And it's their first formal meeting after almost 20 years or so. There was an interim meeting that happened last year, but this week they will meet for the first time and decide how they too will play into Fiji's, you know, development agenda. So the fact that the traditional leaders are here and in a very high-ranking traditional leaders is quite significant. And what we understand is they will play some sort of role in day one of the GCC. How much of the role remains to be seen, and I will have more on that later this afternoon, Agnes.
Awesome. Letha, as you said, this meeting's quite significant. So what sort of impact will this have?
Well, the SBC statement that came out very late last night upon, you know, requests from the media is calling it historic occasion because, as we mentioned at the beginning, there is currently no formal forum where the chiefs of, you know, the 24 or so member countries of the Pacific Islands Forum will get to meet and get to inform nation building in their own countries. And now this is different per countries. There are some states in the Pacific where traditional leaders have, you know, direct input in the nation's development agenda, but it's not the case across Oceania. So what's going to happen is that this Pacific Traditional Leaders Forum, the idea is while it'll be formed at FESPEC in June, it's going to become a regular event. And the idea is that traditional leaders feed into the policy of each of the region's governments. And what we understand as well is that they will almost mirror the Pacific Islands Forum in that they will sit to discuss the region's biggest challenges. So, you know, things like climate change, sustainable development, and what they're saying is that traditional leaders bring wisdom and intergenerational leadership, and they give access to mana that elected public officials don't yet possess. But with little transparency around this event, it's not clear to me exactly how this this leaders forum will engage with the Pacific Island Forum leaders meeting, Agnes. But hopefully that'll clear up once we complete the traditional rituals on Bao this morning.
Yeah, Letha, look, that seems like quite a display of royalty from across the Pacific of those who are attending. Are you just aware of that as the only ones that are attending today, or are there other, I suppose, other countries that may be participating today?
Well, look, the first message that came out from the office of the king, the Maori king, that is that Tonga was also included. But, you know, the king of Tonga, or Tongan monarchy for that matter, is pretty significant in Fiji, being our closest neighbor to the east. So there is no bringing the head of the Tongan monarchy to Fiji without the entire country knowing and being a part of it. So I don't think that the king of Tonga will be in attendance, Agnes. And what we do understand is that the meeting in June in Hawaii will include the entire Pacific. So that's going to be quite historic and probably the first of its kind ever.
Wow. It looks like it's going to be exciting stuff. Thank you very much for just giving us the update of what's happening at the moment, Letha.
Malo, and vinaka to you, Agnes.
No worries. That, of course, is our ABC reporter in Fiji, Letha Mavono, here on Pacific Beat.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sportspeople to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. While businesses in Solomon Islands will have until the end of this week to stop using single-use plastic bags or risk facing serious penalties. Now, the ban targets plastic shopping bags, cups, plates, cutlery, even polystyrene takeaway plates and plastic bottles. Now, it follows a six-month grace period to give businesses and consumers time to adjust to the changes. And to find out how they are tracking, we are joined by Gilat Thuhanuku, Chair of the Solomon Islands Chamber of Commerce. So with that, I say welcome to the show.
Hi, sorry, I can hear you now.
Awesome. Hey, Gila, thank you for joining us this morning. I mean, it has been a six-month grace period. It's about to end. I'm just wondering, how do businesses feel about this change?
I think because it's fallen in over the break. I know that a lot of businesses have been adjusting slowly, particularly for consumers, to the no plastic in preparation. But as all things in Solomon's, you kind of wait and really see what the enforcement is going to look like. And that will probably really determine, you know, how well this is going to go.
Mm. Are they confident that they can manage, though?
Is this in terms of the government or in terms of businesses?
In terms of businesses, apologies.
From what we've seen, particularly in the capital, we don't have a lot of feedback in terms of businesses in the provinces. But in terms of the capital, there is phasing. I know in the consultation period, there were asking for a 12-month grace period. I think that was in relation to stock that they had to use up, but they've gone with the 6 months. So far, the phasing has happened, and we've seen that some have actually already gone to not offering plastic bags. So that's just strictly speaking in terms of the capital, Honiara. Broadly, in terms of the country, we don't really have a picture on that yet.
Yeah, and you had just mentioned, of course, when there was consultation, they'd asked for 12 months. Of course, they didn't get it. It's only been 6 months. So if a business has not, you know, complied, I believe there are serious penalties. So what does that look like? Is it a financial penalty?
Yeah, that's around. From our understanding of how it works is there is a maximum penalty. So usually it's around 10,000 units, or it depends on the offence. But it's really when the cases hit the courts or the enforcement happens that you really will see whether they go straight for the maximum or there's actually going to be a tiered response. So a lot of we do know that also they updated the city council or act, which also allows for spot fines and certain things like that. I know that they're doing that with shop fronts and that they've been actively enforcing that. So we're assuming that for plastics, it might look the same, but it'll be the first time for the country. So we're sort of, conscious of the fact that, you know, especially in the early stages, that there will be some, you know, hiccups possibly. But in terms of business preparation, I mean, the imports stopped in September. And in terms of awareness, there is clear understanding that even if you have stock, you won't be able to use it as of at the end of the 6 months grace period.
Yeah, so then what does happen then with that remaining stock?
It's at the cost of the business. So at the consultation, it was done quite, rushed because it was to come in for the Pacific Games. And there was not a lot of clarity on whether or not there would be some incentive or some trade-off for that amount of stock. We're aware that they were supposed to collect data on how much was left. Again, because of the games and going straight into Christmas and New Year, and government kind of shut down and gone into caretaker, these are the sort of data or feedback we have not heard back as businesses. But things are picking up now in terms of government coming back into work mode again. So it will be something that we'll have to follow up. But, you know, from past experience, we're not sort of seeing any, possibility of incentive or trade-off at this point.
So then, what type of businesses will the plastic ban impact the most, though?
First will be the retail, and that's really because it's consumer-driven. Convenience and, you know, our transportation doesn't allow for a lot of, you know, carrying bulky things. So it will really be consumers, so our retail outlets the most. We do have, you know, water manufacturing, but because they're keeping the 1.5-litre, the bottle still, they'll keep going with that. But I think it will be quite noticeable in the retail area and sort of the catering and restaurant, but probably there are more alternatives there that we've already seen that people are bringing in. So I think also for consumers here, it's going to really hit them once the ban comes into force in March, and we probably see more, might get more of a reaction from consumers from this point.
Mm. If you're just tuning in, we are speaking to Chair of the Solomon Islands Chamber of Commerce, Akile Tuhanuku, in regards to this ban on plastic shopping bags, cups, plates, cutlery, polystyrene takeaway plates. Yeah, just like you said, what has been the feedback, I suppose, that businesses may have had from consumers? Because this is definitely a mind shift and a behaviour shift too, isn't it?
I think initially there was a lot of, naturally at the shopfront people, the convenience aspect. But because it was broadly leading up to the games, I think unlike a few other probably moves like this, people are more aware that this is coming from the government and it's been gazetted. So there, as we all know, you'll have disgruntled consumers. But at this point, there's not a lot of backlash, I think, on the businesses, apart from, the complaints of convenience. But as we're saying, for a lot of us, we're really going to watch from this point the enforcement and probably the consumers, whether how much they push back. But in some places, it's kind of been accepted. And in some, there's been complaints, but nothing that's significant. But we have seen a real reduction because we used to have flooding on the roads during wet season. And there has been a real reduction in terms of plastics clogging up the drains and waterways and causing the floods onto the roads that used to cause us a big problem. So, again, it's very early to tell whether people in general are noting the difference, and therefore it's kind of impacting how much that they're pushing back on it. Mm. It's really probably early to tell.
Yeah, definitely would have to take some time until you can see some proper results. So then, Gila, where does the Chamber stand on this whole issue?
Look, we're from the Pacific. It's really hard not to be aware of issues and challenges when it's around climate change, sustainability. Chamber of Commerce, some of the work we're doing is actually in that space, setting up a business resilience, a sustainability council. We're also part of a lot of the programs that are about, infrastructure resilience. So definitely for us, it makes a lot of sense. And we do know that in the long term, there will be benefits from it. But understanding that we've got to work with government to sort of just manage the transition so that there's not a lot of losses, because we've had a negative economic impact growth for the last 4 or 5 years. And things like this are great, and you'll see it in the long term, the returns. But in the short term, it is tough on businesses to take on the costs of making this change, as I mentioned earlier. For most of us, we're expecting a write-off for some of our members that, you hadn't anticipated for, and it's probably tough doing it in this current environment. So definitely supportive of these kind of initiatives, and it's good to see that government's actually taking a stronger lead on it than some of the other things that they've done. So we would like to support that, but we've also got to be really aware and conscious that it's done in a way that it's sustainable also for businesses.
Of course, I suppose it's a positive in terms even of climate change, right?
Oh, absolutely. We've seen changes to weather patterns and flooding, which impact our business operations. So it's no longer what you call the new norm. It is the norm for us. So we've got to address it. It's long outstanding. But, dialogue is important because we know the costs to business in a way that our stakeholders won't. And so and it's been great, actually. That's why having the consultations were important. Even if we didn't get some of the things we requested, but at least our side of things is taken note of. And there's been a greater degree of discussion on how to make things go a bit easier.
Absolutely. Hey, look, it sounds like some positive results there for the souls. So we just thank you for your time just to give a bit of insight into what's happening there.
No worries.
Tagia tumas, Kila. That is Kila Tuhanuku, Chair of the Chamber of Commerce. Up next, we've got News Wrap with producer Mackenzie Smith. Yep, let's head around the region. Let's see what the headlines are. What is happening out there? Of course, that's brought to us by our producer, Mackenzie Smith. Good morning.
Morning, Andy.
Yeah, to PNG, though, three hostages, goodness, including an Australian pilot, have been released. What actually initially happened?
Yeah, well, the three men had been in Mount Sisa in PNG's Highlands on Monday as part of a scheduled stop they were making there when they were taken captive at a remote telecommunications site. The police commissioner, David Manning, says after large numbers of security forces were then deployed to the area to rescue them, the men were allowed to leave by their captors in their helicopter. He says, David Manning, that is, the group responsible for the kidnapping had been seeking a ransom for their release. That didn't happen. Police are now pursuing those responsible. Manning has called them domestic terrorists and says if they resist arrest, they will be killed.
Wow. What has the company who employed these men, what have they said?
Well, Heavy Lift Aviation, who employed the two local telecommunications technicians and the Australian pilot, says the kidnapping occurred when the trio were collecting equipment. The company says a group of locals then emerged from the bushes and held them for several hours. Heavy Lift Aviation says the company's relieved the men had the presence of mind to be able to fly away from the scene. And the kidnapping comes after an Australian professor and two local researchers were taken hostage in the same area just last year.
Goodness, and even elsewhere in PNG doesn't sound any better, but police say they've resolved a siege situation involving an Australian man.
Yeah, according to the police, this happened over the weekend. A 51-year-old Australian man barricaded himself in a house after stabbing himself and threatening to commit suicide. Police say he's believed to have previously been discovered sexually assaulting a girl under the age of 10. Police didn't say where the siege occurred, but they say when they arrived at the scene, more than 6 hours of negotiations eventually led to police breaching the unit and the man surrendering. He's currently under police guard in hospital and is expected to face criminal charges in the coming days. The police commissioner, David Manning, says the allegations against the man are sickening.
Absolutely, having to hear that. Look, Mackenzie, thank you so much for bringing our headlines this morning. Really appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks a lot.
Join me, Melissa Makin, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DuBois. And yes, please tune into that program with Melissa Makin. It's going to be a good one. Well, from the last sort of lot of news that we heard there in the news wrap, at times bad news stories in the media can often feel quite overwhelming, a phenomena that's been dubbed news fatigue. Take PNG, for example. Already this year, there have been violent riots in the capital, an outbreak of deadly tribal fighting in the Highlands, and a nationwide fuel shortage threatening to bring the economy to a shuddering halt. While the Director General of the Melanesian Spearhead Group is the diplomatic grouping of Melanesian countries, reckons the regional media needs to do more to give people a sense of hope and pride. Leonard Loma is not advocating the media move away from its traditional watchdog role, but instead he is trying to bring together national broadcasters from member countries to see if they can generate and share more good news stories.
Get our national broadcasters to meet together and see if they can better coordinate their activities in a way that helps build pride in being who we are as Melanesians, and in a subtle way or in a soft way, build the self-esteem of our people and the The aim of it is with, of course, better self-esteem. People would have a different mindset towards how they conduct themselves, and perhaps we would see better developments take place in MSG.
And why do you think that's important to share news from around the region with the region?
Well, for me, if the idea of the establishment of MSG is to develop more enhanced cooperation amongst MSG countries, one of the best ways of getting people to feel like they are part of a community or part of a MSG country is to share news so that all of them know what's happening around, and then develop specific programs in relation to the Melanesian customs and cultures. Too often, I think we do this one-off story, but we don't consistently disseminate information about what's happening in each other's country. For instance, when I see the Pacific Way, ABC does, the Pacific sports program, I see something that could be borrowed from that template and used by our MSG national broadcasters to see if they can specifically do stories on the Melanesian way, the Melanesian sports. You know, there's a whole host of Melanesians in NRL. We hear one-off stories about them. But it's not done in a sustained way, which would develop a sense of pride. It gives our youth something to look to.
Going back to your first motivation, which was to build up pride in people, where's the motivation for that come from? Is it because there's often a deluge of bad stories, bad news stories, so to speak, about things happening in Melanesia?
I think, you know, the stories about actual happenings in MSG countries, we should not try and stop that. For me, it is the role of broadcasters and news media to tell it as it is. But as national broadcasters, they were created by governments to promote development happenings in the countries. And for me, I don't think they do enough in that area. I think they should be reminded that, yes, tell whatever is happening, as you should and you must, but do not forget that one of your important roles is to develop stories that promote and engender a sense of pride in who we are and encourages our people to develop a positive approach to life. There's like, you know, there's a lot of feel-good stories, you know, but they're not being told often enough. For instance, was in Honiara just last week, and I saw a group of young ladies that make bricks from plastic waste and sand. And this is young ladies doing that sort of activity. It helps them pay for their education. It also solves the plastic waste problem. And for me, it's that type of stories that I want, so that it gives people a chance to not be inundated with just negative stories, but at least it gives them a hope that, yes, we can be better.
You mentioned the media should still cover the goings on. You're not seeking or talking about any sort of reduction in their watchdog role to keep governments accountable and things like that.
Not at all. I'm probably one person who does not believe in trying to limit the right of broadcasters and media to report what is actually happening. That is the fundamental role. And I may disagree with what they produce, but I will not and never advocate for a restriction to that right.
That's Leonard Luma, Director General of the Melanesian Spearhead Group, speaking to Liam Fox. Its technology is already being used extensively by immigration authorities to verify the identity of passport holders at airports, as well as law enforcement agencies throughout Australia for crime prevention. In a bid to combat repeat retail offending, a facial recognition technology trial, or FRT, are now being used in supermarkets in Aotearoa in Australia. But experts are concerned the technology could discriminate against people of colour, particularly those from Indigenous and Pacifica communities. So, to speak more on this matter, is Associate Professor at the University of Auckland Business School, Gehan Gunasekera, who researches information and data privacy also with that. I say, kia ora, Professor.
Yes, good morning.
Yeah, thank you for joining us this morning. I'm just wondering quickly, are you able to maybe explain firstly maybe the differences between, because you know there's CCTV footage that we know that is already around us at the moment, but then there's FRTs. Is there a slight difference in the way that they operate?
Absolutely. They're qualitatively different, because when you're dealing with facial recognition technology, you are dealing with the ability to instantly identify someone autonomously or automatically without a human being involved, and that's a jump in terms of technology. And these technologies are getting better all the time. So we know that, you know, they've trialed it. They can work even if you try and cover part of your face. You have a hat or a mask. It can measure the distance between your eye and your nose, the bridge of your nose, or something like that. And very quickly, they can match that to a template, and they can say, yes, this is individual X. But at the same time, mistakes have happened, as you say, with certain demographics.
Yeah, and I know that this technology has been around for a little while now, but there seems to be now an increase of these FRTs in supermarkets now. I mean, is this a proactive movement forward or not?
Well, the good thing about the trial in New Zealand is that it has been very closely monitored and watched by our privacy commissioner, and he's running an inquiry in sync with the trial, and clearly we, under our legislation, there is now the power for the commissioner to order an organization to make changes if it finds that its practices are not up to scratch, its security is not up to scratch, or it's using the data for some ulterior purpose. Then the commissioner will be in a very strong position, given his powers of inquiry, to order the a supermarket chain to make whatever changes are needed to align with the privacy requirements. The problem we have, though, is that we have the generic legislation. We don't have a biometric-specific code of practice, and I think that's what a lot of organisations like the Privacy Foundation in New Zealand are pushing for that.
Yeah, and let's sort of get into privacy, because, you know, when we... With the facial recognition technology, I know a lot of businesses say it'll improve the safety and security, but really, at the cost of your picture maybe being run through some sort of criminal database, it's like treating people as suspects without probable cause. I mean, is that a fair assessment or not?
Yes, it is. And that is the objectionable part of it, that everyone's face is going to be captured, because the only way you'll be able to screen someone who is undesirable. And so there are two issues here. One is, how are they going to enroll the data for the people they want to exclude? So presumably these are people who've been trespassed as having a history of violence against staff, perhaps, or a serial shoplifter or something like that. It's not clear where they're going to get that data from. Is it from the police? Is it from their own, their own kind of experience or history? And the second thing is, everyone who goes into the store will have their face scanned and matched against that database. And what they have promised is that they will then immediately delete your image if you are not a positive match. Now, we need verification of that. And I think these are the kinds of things, the devil is in the detail in these systems, and they need to be very closely monitored to make sure that they are not, in fact, collecting a huge trove of everyone's image. And it's going to be used, if there's a security hack or something, and we might find all our images somehow on the dark web, and that would be of concern.
Absolutely. Now, the trial that has been run, of course, by this Australian-based tech company called VixVision, again, are behind these FRTs. They even state that the system only can reach like a 90% facial match. That's the threshold. I'm wondering, is that enough accuracy? Because I know for many years, this technology has been less than accurate for, let's say, brown, black people, Pacific or Indigenous, more so than white people.
Yes, and women of colour as well as the demographic that's been mentioned. So that's right. There's a lot of evidence, especially from overseas, that these certain demographics, it doesn't work as well. And so this, their 90% is, I'm presuming it's an average figure, doesn't take into account those specific types of groups who could be victimized. The only safeguard they have promised is that no decision will be made to exclude anyone other than two staff members independently sort of conferring, checking that the match is in fact accurate. But we all know that that's a fairly spurious kind of safeguard, because people tend to trust the technology more than their own eyes. And, you know, you'd have to be a very skilled individual to be able to tell that the biometric identification was inaccurate. And you know, they're not going to have highly trained people in each of these supermarkets. It'll be presumably just two of their normal staff members, perhaps senior staff members. So there are all sorts of issues here about the degree of human monitoring and intervention in each case before the automated decision is made to exclude someone. And overseas, there have been cases where people have been embarrassed, humiliated. You know, there's been, and you know, imagine if you are the person who is suddenly apprehended and said, excuse me, you know, we've detected that you are a person who is not allowed to be on our premises. And, you know, all your friends and everyone around you will wonder what's going on. So I think we have these, it's a trial, so we'll have to see how the trial works. And the second thing that comes to mind is we'll need to see the data after the trial to see, did it actually reduce the incidence of shoplifting, and did it actually lead to a decrease in violence? So these are the, I think we need to have a cost-benefit analysis here.
Absolutely, definitely. And we will get into that. Look, if you're tuning in to Pacific Beat, we are speaking with Associate Professor at the University of Auckland, Business School, Gihan Guneskera, on facial recognition technology, and really, does this discriminate against people of colour? I'm wondering, we've spoken about a couple of groups there, black, brown, Indigenous, Pacifica. Is there any other certain groups of people that may be discriminated?
Well, in Aotearoa, of course, we have to consider, you know, the role of the MOCO, and we need to consider that a person's face in Te Ao Māori is very, very sacred to them. And it's part of who they are. It's more than just an identifying feature. And so I can't speak for our Indigenous people, but I know that from talking to people that many of our Indigenous leaders are very concerned about, you know, well, obviously there's a discriminatory aspect, but there is also the issue of whether it's effective or not. It's a question of you're taking that person's face, and that is something that is very sacred to them. And so there's an issue there, a cultural sensitivity issue, which I'm not sure that these companies have taken into account. And one would need to see what kinds of consultations they've entered into to be reassured in that respect.
Yes, I was just going to ask that, whether this is a matter of companies having to consult our Indigenous or Pacifica communities, because cultural awareness is something that really is what our people consider as a basis to be, you know, to trust these systems. Again, like you talk about facial tattoos, the mokos, we've got our First Nations people here in Australia. Often a lot of us, we really do look the same in some sense. So do you think that these companies really need to sit down and actually have a proper consultation?
Completely. I completely agree with you. I think that's the bottom line. They need to do that to have any kind of legitimacy. And that trust is critical, because if you don't have that trust, then people will think this is just another stick to beat up our particular group on. And in New Zealand, of course, you know, we have a government at the moment that's focused on you know, reversing some of the policies of the previous government in terms of indigenous issues. And so this just plays into that. And, you know, those people will feel even more victimized, and that now we have these companies lining up. So, I mean, on the one hand, you know, we have to see that there is a particular problem that has been highlighted, and that's violence against supermarket staff, a huge increase in shoplifting. Now, those are serious social problems. Now, the question is, how are those problems best addressed? Are they addressed by facial recognition is perhaps part of the solution, but I would question whether, you know, it's being given a disproportionate role. And sometimes technology doesn't solve all social problems. Unfortunately, there's around the globe there is this move to say, oh well, we can get a technology fix, and that'll fix, you know, whatever problem it is. And we know that overseas police, for example, have used these technologies. But time and again, the research has shown that all that happens is that you reinforce the existing social problems. And while you might have a short-term decrease in the bad statistics, in the longer term, you end up reinforcing the disadvantage and you know, the sense of victimization, and the situation just keeps getting worse.
Yeah, and that is something, of course, as you said earlier, it's a bit of a wait and see, just to even see what the results are, if it actually improves staff safety and lessens crime. But look, we appreciate your time this morning, Professor.
No, you're very welcome, and it's been good talking to you.
Thank you so much. Associate Professor at the University of Auckland Business School, Gehan Gunasekera. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at our main story today. Traditional leaders from several Pacific countries are meeting in Fiji today for its first ever gathering of its kind alongside the Great Council of Chiefs. Our reporter in Fiji, Lethe Movono, is there.
The fact that the traditional leaders are here and in the very high-ranking traditional leaders is quite significant. And what we understand is they will play some sort of role in day one of the GCC.
And finding our stories, you head to abc.net.au/Pacific. I'll be back at same time, 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow, but you can hear us this afternoon at 5 p.m. Coming up next is your news. After that, it's Nija Daily. Until next time, o tua o whātou, I'm Aggie Tupou, and you've been tuning into Pacific Beat.